You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 19th of February 2015 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to Midori House, coming to you live from Studio One. I'm Andrew Muller. On today's show,
I suspect what's happening here is the Russians are trying to make some sort of a point, and I don't think we should dignify it with too much of a response.
British Prime Minister David Cameron responds to the presence of two Russian bombers off the southern coast of the UK. We'll assess the politics of airspace with the historian Dr. James Boyce and the commentator Martin Plout, who'll join me in the studio to discuss that and the day's other talking points. Also ahead, Egypt blocks a shipment of books depicting revolutionary graffiti on the streets of Cairo and beyond. We'll ask why the government there is still so nervous about the printed page.
There's a litany of 100 plus laws that limit free expression here. And what artists and writers do is they have to work around these laws constantly.
Also this evening, we'll leaf through the news weeklies out of the United States and review the latest book releases with Fleur MacDonald. That's all coming up on Midori House on Monocle 24 right now. But ahead of a typically action-packed hour, Paul Osborne is here with the latest world news.
Germany has rejected a Greek request for a six-month loan extension from the Eurozone. It says the proposal was not substantive, turning it down just a few minutes after the European Commission had called the request positive. Greece risks running out of money by the end of February without agreement. German Finance Minister Wolfgang Schäuble.
With all the skeptics we suffered 3 years ago, 4 years ago, whether this will ever work. Portugal, together with other member states which have been under program, is the best proof that it, in general, has worked.
Greece is not requesting an extension of the existing bailout, as that would mean continuing with austerity measures. In Athens, supporters of the new government say they're sure the rest of Europe will back down.
It's important for Greece to stay on the way of getting back her economy. It's important for the Greek people to hear some good news. So I really hope that we will have some agreement, at least on Friday.
There's been intense shelling around the eastern Ukrainian city of Donetsk, piling further pressure on the precarious ceasefire. Government forces say they're coming under attack from pro-Moscow rebels near the city of Mariupol. The leaders of Russia, France and Germany have criticized continued violations of the truce after a telephone call, while Ukraine's president has vowed to respond if there are any further breaches of the ceasefire. Meanwhile, British aircraft have intercepted Russian long-range bombers spotted off the southwest coast of England. The RAF scrambled fighter jets to intercept the planes on Wednesday evening. The Russian bombers were escorted until they'd flown further away. Britain's defence minister has warned that Russia could put pressure on the Baltic states in the coming months. Lise Kangskeps, a journalist in Estonia.
We are talking about the possibility of hybrid war or attacks against Estonia or the other Baltic states. But these days, I would say that people, I don't see any panic on the streets, and I think people are taking it rather calmly. Of course, you know, there has been a lot of talk about what should be done and how should we fight it in case we have to.
Niger has declared 3 days of national mourning after 37 people died in an airstrike close to the border with Nigeria. They were attending a funeral, while across the border a major operation against Boko Haram militants was underway. But Nigerian military sources said their planes were not involved in the raid. Hundreds of people have joined a candlelit vigil for Kayla Muller, the American aid worker who died while being held by Islamic State militants. She'd been abducted 18 months earlier in Syria. The militants claim she died in a Jordanian airstrike, but that's been disputed. In Kayla's hometown, Prescott, Arizona, her brother Eric spoke of the pain her family's going through.
You were my first friend, my best friend, my only sister. My heart aches for you and what you went through. I have a hole in my soul that will never be replaced. I miss you. I love you. I cannot believe you are gone from my life.
A man who spent 24 years in prison before being acquitted at a retrial is suing police in New York City. Derek Deacon says detectives mishandled the investigation into the killing of a teenager in 1989. He was eventually given a retrial in 2012, when a different man was identified as the killer. The jury at that retrial took just 9 minutes to acquit him. That's the latest news on Monocle 24.
Vanuit Londen. Dit is Monocle 24.
London으로부터 Monocle 24입니다.
De Londres. Essa é a Monocle 24.
Oi, London. This is Monocle 24.
Ot London, tu é Monocle 24.
Fra London, dette er Monocle 24.
From London. This is Londres.
Hollanda.
London. London으로부터
Hong Kong.
Hong Kong.
Zurich.
London.
This is Monocle 24.
You're listening to Midori House. The time here in London is 18.06. It's 13.06 in New York. And joining me now with their take on today's news, here in the studio, I have the author, historian and academic Dr. James Boyes and Martin Plout, Africa specialist and fellow at the Institute of Commonwealth Studies. Welcome both back to the programme. We will start tonight in the skies over Cornwall, where Royal Air Force Typhoons have been scrambled to escort Russian Tu-95 bombers away from British airspace. This is doubtless all terrific fun for the pilots of both sides, who get to post footage of each other waving on YouTube, but is it the sort of behaviour likely to result in someone losing an eye? David Cameron says Russia is trying to make some sort of a point. This is what the British PM said a little earlier today.
At no time did the Russian military aircraft cross into UK sovereign airspace. I think what this episode demonstrates is that we do have the fast jets, the pilots, the systems in place to protect the United Kingdom. I suspect what's happening here is the Russians are trying to make some sort of a point, and I don't think we should dignify it with too much of a response.
Martin Plout, I'll ask you first. I actually quite liked that from David Cameron. There was something really delightfully patronising about Russia trying to make some sort of a point. He's sort of reacting much as if he might to sort of a small angry mob with pitchforks outside the gates of his estate. Do we have any idea what point the Russians might be trying to make?
I think they're just trying to make life uncomfortable for any of the NATO powers who are now camped on their doorstep. I mean, you know, one shouldn't be surprised about this. I mean, can you imagine if the Russians were playing footsie with the Canadians or with the Mexicans and, you know, had, you know, taken a chunk of their territory? How do you think the Americans would respond? So the Russians are doing the same to us. They're now, you know, we've sent more troops into Estonia, Latvia and Lithuania. We've got a new spearhead brigade up there. We've got, you know, we are trying to help Ukraine to the best of our ability. But of course, they're not members of NATO, so they don't get the NATO guarantee. So, you know, Putin's basically shaking his cage back.
This is all rather silly, though, James, really, isn't it? I mean, I'm sure, as I said, it's a terrific day out for the pilots, who probably get somewhat bored otherwise. And it must be terribly exciting to hear the instruction to scramble if you are, in fact, a Typhoon pilot. But there is a dangerous subtext to this, isn't there? Because this is not the first such incident by any means in recent weeks and months. More seriously, there's been reports of Russian military aircraft flying around in the Baltic Sea with their transponders turned off. How big a risk is Russia taking with this sort of stunt?
I think one of the problems is, as soon as you start putting aircraft in close proximity like this, you ramp up the potential for some in-air activity that will leave one of those aircraft tumbling toward the earth far too fast. I think, you know, you were, you know, having a bit of a pop at the Prime Minister with regard to his response, and that's all well and good. But I think that there's another way of looking at that, which is that it would be very easy to see how, this close to a general election, the Prime Minister could try and make real political hay out of this and grandstand on a national security basis and try and talk up the idea of, you know, the Conservatives standing up and firm in terms of foreign policy, and especially compared to someone like Ed Miliband, of course, who has no experience in government. But I think he's not doing that. I think he's rightly playing this down and trying to talk about this in quite considered terms. There's no doubt that Putin is, as Martin rightly pointed out, trying to rattle NATO's cage. He sees NATO expansion into Central and Eastern Europe during the 1990s and subsequent years as a rationale for that. It's important to recognise, of course, that those nations who joined NATO did so quite freely and were very happy to get the NATO guarantee along with all the market forces and market reform and democratic reform that came along with it.
Martin, you're probably quite right in suggesting that from the point of view of Moscow, all those Western forces positioned along their borders by land, air and sea probably looks not dissimilar to the spectacle of bear bombers doing loops off the coast of Cornwall. But aside from the risk of an actual accident, isn't the trouble with the encroachment on other people's airspace that you just end up looking like kind of a jerk? I mean, I'm thinking of my own mercifully limited experience of such things, of trying to sleep in places like Beirut and Gaza City while the Israeli Air Force fly low circuits above the buildings. It's not a way to win friends and influence people.
Well, I mean, the difference is that, you know, when you're in Gaza City, the, you know, Hamas and, you know, the various groups don't have the missiles to shoot you down. The Brits do. And, you know, the one thing that is apparently unclear about what Cameron was saying was that they were not in British airspace, because there are reports in the Telegraph right now saying that, in fact, people have seen them over Cornwall. Now, if they are really flying over Cornwall, they are really getting close to, you know, rubbing our noses in it. And, you know, these things are damn dangerous. As James was saying, you know, you can end up with a plane moving towards the Earth too fast, and then what? Where are you?
We will try to rise above jokes about people in Cornwall pointing at aeroplanes. But that possibility, James, that you mentioned about the possibility of accidents, are they factored into these kind of deployments? There was obviously a case in 2001 where there was a collision between an American and a Chinese aircraft over the South China Sea, and that was there was obvious tensions and difficulties about that, but realistically, do the powers who send these planes up recognise that kind of incident as kind of the cost of doing business?
Well, darn you, sir, you took the very expression that I was literally about to refer to that incident, because of course that happened during the very first weeks of the George W. Bush administration and was the first test of his diplomatic skills. And of course it was Colin Powell who was dispatched to that part of the world, and it was ultimately resolved. But that happened because you had two aircraft that came into too close proximity, bumped, and you ended up with a forced landing over China. So I think that there's no doubt. I mean, I've been on this channel many times talking about Vladimir Putin and how he is really ramping up issues and getting a very limited, muted response from the West. He's constantly pushing, trying to probe and see what he can get away with. It is fascinating, as Martin rightly points out, you know, if these things are over the British coastline, then how the Prime Minister can say they're not over British airspace, I'm at a loss, quite frankly. I presume he must know what he's talking about, but we have seen, as you said, in the last days, similar incidents over the Channel. This is, I think, just another example of Putin trying to probe, trying to push, trying to divert attention from his increasingly problematic domestic situation. That is something which we need to focus upon, this idea that this is a diversionary tactic from those domestic pressures that Putin really is trying to allay at this point, I think.
Just finally on this one, Martin, is it a distraction as far as Putin is concerned from domestic issues? Will this have any particular propaganda value within Russia itself, or is this him making a point outside his country's borders?
I think it's tremendously popular inside Russia. I mean, you know, it's him beating his chest like some sort of alpha male gorilla. And, you know, I mean, he's always, you know, showing himself on horseback, bare-chested, you know, the karate expert and all the rest of it. It goes perfectly with his image and, you know, frankly, Russians love it.
Well, let's look now at the United States, which appears to be conducting an initiative straight out of the something must be done, this is something, therefore we must do it file. It's convening a three-day summit on countering violent extremism. This is a reaction in part to a series of recent events in which Islamist fanatics in Ottawa, Sydney, Paris and Copenhagen have murdered people for guarding war memorials, drinking coffee, drawing pictures or being Jewish. James, isn't the problem, first of all here, one of definition, that extremism can't actually be countered? It needs to be confronted.
Absolutely. And I'm very pleased to hear you say that, because one of the problems you've got is Barack Obama's critics have said just that. Why are we talking about this instead of confronting it? It's all very well and good. Let's have, you know, I think it's a 60-nation delegation visiting the White House to talk about this. It gives the president a great opportunity to say, look, I am doing something. It's like, yes, but what are you doing? You are convening a gathering of the supposedly great and the good to discuss this. But at some point, you have to stop talking and start doing. We are, of course, in a strange position, which is that for the first 10 years of this relatively young millennium, the suggestion was that the United States was going around the world, intervening and doing too much and blowing things up too often. Now we are in a situation, arguably, where there is a logistical, existential threat to Western interests in that part of the world. We're seeing some horrendous imagery coming out of that that region. And it seems that this administration is so determined not to be George W. Bush that they are inclined to do very little. We're going to talk, I'm sure, a little later on about the upcoming presidential election. What's important to note is that Barack Obama has a very short window of opportunity, because as soon as the votes start getting counted in the primaries, nothing will happen in terms of US foreign policy. So if anything is going to happen, it has to happen, in my opinion, within this calendar year, of which there are only now 11 months left.
Martin, Vice President Joe Biden at the summit has said, you know, the thing people often do at these things, saying we have to provide an affirmative alternative for immigrant communities, which it could be argued that the US is actually already a pretty good model for. But isn't this buying into the idea, a fallacious one in my opinion at least, that terrorism, especially of this sort, is purely a reactive phenomenon, that we must have done something to upset these people?
Yeah, which it certainly isn't. I mean, the people that we're up against are determined that we are up against them, whatever we do. So it is not reactive in any shape, way, or form. But let me disagree with James, if I may, on this one, in the sense that, you know, I think there isn't anything you can do about it. There is no simple place that you can go to and, you know, send a couple of battalions of Marines in and take them out. There is nowhere to go. And this is why, you know, a much more subtle strategy is what Obama is trying to play. The difficulty is that it is hard to sell. So he goes around saying, look, Islam is not the problem. I'm not going to go around talking about Islamic terrorism, because I don't want to use the word Islam, because it isn't quite right. And don't you see that it's not Islam that are terrorists? It is terrorists that are terrorists. Now, that's a hard one to sell. And according to a recent poll, 68% of the American public think that Obama should be tougher about all of this. And I can see why. The problem is there is nobody obvious to go and beat up. Who do you kill? Who do you go and blow up? There is no nexus that you can destroy. And you have to confront this ideologically. And at the end of the day, that is why I think Obama is right in trying to do this, but it's a damned hard policy to sell.
James, Martin credits the president there with a subtle strategy. Some would argue subtle to the point of invisibility. Is it just as you suggested, that he is just scared of sounding like George W. Bush, or worse still, being like George W. Bush? Or is there actually an argument here to be won?
Okay, let's address some of those points. Many observers have actually suggested that what Obama has done is completed George W. Bush's third and fourth terms in terms of the practices he's engaged in, some of the things which have been continued, which would have done so even if W. could have run for a third and fourth term. Just for the record, I'm not suggesting here that the Americans should send, you know, its strike forces in. What I believe is that it should be orchestrating a response in that part of the world, led by nations from that part of the world who face the greatest threat. Places like Egypt and Jordan, these nations receive vast fortunes in terms of Western defense expenditure and largesse. They are the nations who are most directly affected by this. Their own national armies vastly outnumber the numbers that are involved with regard to ISIS. And again, you know, I think Martin and I are just going to disagree on this one. I think there is targets you could take out with regard to these organizations. Nobody seems to be in any doubt about where they are. They're clearly being seen on satellite photography. These organizations are making it very clear where they are, what they are doing. Most analysts agree that they are relatively limited in number, and a national, international coalition of nations from that part of the world could presumably move on these locations and take them out. The great question is, why are nations in that part of the world so hesitant to act against a threat which is clearly growing day by day and is not just some sort of intellectual threat, but an actual clear and present danger to those nations in that part of the world?
Reasonable points all, and we have in recent days, for the worst imaginable reasons, seen Jordan and Egypt in particular develop something of an enthusiasm for getting involved. But isn't the problem, or one of the problems, I guess the major problem potentially that Barack Obama does have, and a final thought on this one from you, Martin, that it's, can he really go back to the American people and say, I've got a great idea for an incredibly complicated and unpleasant war in the Middle East. I've got really no idea how it ends or what the victory conditions are.
Well, exactly. But I mean, I do agree with James that, and here's a change. That,
I appreciate it.
That, you know, it is really something that has to be sorted out on the ground by the nations on the ground. But I mean, you know, if I can use a couple of African comparisons, you know, Somalia has been sorted up to a point, but it's been sorted by the African neighbours. Not always happily, but it is moving in the right direction-ish. Nigeria, by comparison with Boko Haram, is not being sorted out yet because Nigeria is just being so bloody hopeless about the thing, and their neighbours, apart from Chad, are not doing much. So, you know, at the end of the day, I do agree it is really, at the end of the day, something that has to be sorted out on the ground rather than in Washington.
Very quickly, you ask, can he go back to the American people and talk about this? He has already sent a resolution to Congress asking for an authorization to take the battle to ISIS. And Congress has now come back and said, Mr. President, you have not asked for enough. We want a more tougher resolution giving you more powers. So we're in an interesting debate here. The president is being told to ask for more power by Congress to take on this threat in the Middle East. So we'll see how that develops.
We're going to take a short break now. You're listening to Midori House, here with me, Andrew Muller, along with James Boyce and Martin Plout. When we return, we will look at the latest jockeying in the race for the GOP nomination, and we'll look at the release of Burundian journalist Bob Rugurika.
Should cities ban the car? Can we make truly sustainable metropolises? What happens if neighbourhoods lose their corner shops? How do you put a stop to suburban decay? Children belong in big bad capitals? Can Detroit be saved? Can Sydney become a cycle capital? Can we learn to love concrete? And are rich cities always boring? If you want the answers to the big questions facing our cities, you need to tune in to The Urbanist, Monocle 24 Radio's weekly show about the cities we live in. Expect global reports, great interviews, passionate debate, and some surprises too, because drag star taxi drivers, love motel owners, and retail rebels also get their say. Presented by me, Andrew Tuck, The Urbanist premieres every Thursday at 1900 hours London time, and you can also download it from monocle.com or iTunes.
And welcome back to Midori House here on Monocle 24. Still with me are James Boyce and Martin Plout. Now let's stay in the United States, where 627 days from now, that proportion of its citizenry which can be bothered will decide who gets to be the most powerful person on Earth. Where the Democrats are concerned, it's difficult to find bookmakers who'll take bets on Hillary Clinton being the nominee. The Republican field looks more open, though hopefully not as open as it did last time, to people who should really have been incarcerated in a facility for the irrecoverably bewildered. James, the reason we are discussing this is that Rand Paul looks like he will be the first to properly throw his hat into the ring. He's made an announcement about how he's going to make an announcement or something on April 7th, I think I'm right in saying. Are we taking him seriously?
Yeah, we need to take him very seriously. A question is, of course, at what point does an announcement get made and what constitutes a hat in the ring? Because, of course, Governor Scott Walker from Wisconsin, who was in town last week, has already opened a field office in Des Moines, Iowa, ahead of the Iowa caucus. So there's no doubt, whilst he hasn't officially announced, he's got real estate in that part of the world. He's got an office. He is running for the presidency. So we've got him. We've got Rand Paul. Jeb Bush, of course, made a very important keynote speech last night about foreign policy. His hat is in the ring. So we're starting to see a clear field emerging at this point.
Can the Republicans, assuming that the Democratic nominee will be Hillary, yeah, can the Republicans really put two white guys on the ticket?
They could. I mean, there's nothing to stop them from doing otherwise.
But politically, but realistically.
Could they? It's you know, you've got to look at some of the things the GOP have done in the past and think, well, that's quite bewildering. why would you do that? I mean, if you look at the last time they ran, they put two white guys on the ticket. You know, the obvious thing to do would have been to put someone else on the ticket. But of course, they tried that in 2008. And you might remember what happened with Sarah Palin,
indeed,
which was
we do.
A road crash, which completely keeps on giving, quite frankly. Yeah, absolutely. There could be two white guys on the ticket. It wouldn't be the greatest route to political success, but is the alternative just opportunism?
I'm just asking you, James, you know, I defer to your expertise in American politics. I'm just asking if anyone likes my 33-1 pick, Susana Martinez.
I'm thinking not.
Really?
Yeah, I'm thinking not.
Because the thing is, I do remember looking up Sarah Palin for VP weeks out in 2008. Seriously? I could have written my own ticket.
If you had done that, that would have been remarkable. You know, the reason she got chosen, the only reason she got chosen was because John McCain was adamant that he wanted independent, ex-Democrat, Lieberman to be the vice presidential nominee, and until the last minute he believed the GOP would let him get away with it.
And Lieberman, who then would have been a VP nominee for both parties and a pub quiz immortal.
Absolutely.
Martin, do you think the GOP has learned anything, or hope that GOP at least has learned anything from 2012, basically about the unwisdom of letting their primary field be overrun by dingbats?
You know, my problem with American politics is this is one heck of a long way away, not only physically, geographically, but a long time. You know, the election is on the 8th of November 2016.
I know, but it's such good fun.
I'm sorry, I am not going to strain my brain to understand who all these no-hopers are. Let these guys and perhaps even some women sort themselves out, and I will then take some notice in this. The only thing I noticed about this was that the Koch or the Koch brothers, who say they're going to spend $900 million, one person, one family, to buy this election? I'm sorry, you know, I'm not getting involved in this.
It's important to recognise, and with respect, you know, the reason we are talking about this is because whilst the general election is being held in the 8th of November, the process involved in that begins next January in the Iowa caucus and the New Hampshire primary. No, I don't disagree. And this is one of the great problems, is that the American system of government is geared up for campaigning, not for governing. Which is a huge problem. We were talking about what Obama can and can't do. He is a lame duck now, when all eyes are starting to turn to, once again, will Hillary be president? Will Jeb Bush be president? And this causes massive problems because it ekes away at the president's political capital to do anything. So he's almost starting to pack already. And the reason they're having to get the names out so far and get the announcements out so far is, coming back to Martin's very good point, because now we're in the money primary. This is how can we chase the coin so that when we hit the primary season, come Iowa and New Hampshire, that it's all about what George H.W. Bush used to call the big momentum. Who's got the wind behind them, the money behind them? Because if you've got that, you can obliterate your opposition, which is exactly what Romney did 4 years ago.
Okay, well, finally tonight, we'll go to Burundi, where large crowds have taken to the streets of the capital, Bujumbura, to welcome home Bob Rugurika, a well-known journalist who's been freed on bail after being charged with the murders of three Italian nuns, a crime which occurred last September. Martin, this is an extremely strange story. Can you briefly fill us in on why these people in Bujumbura are so happy to see Mr. Rugurika come home?
Well, because he is somebody who speaks truth to power. I don't think it's very complicated.
And this hasn't made him terribly popular with the power.
With the power, exactly. You know, he basically said that when these women were, these poor nuns were murdered, that there were people involved who were from the securities forces, the security services. And essentially, you know, that is why he was picked up and taken away. There was some vague idea that he had somehow spoken to one of the alleged people who'd actually done it, according to the prosecutor. Nobody believed this was true. He's just a popular journalist. There's an election coming up. I don't think we have to look too far.
How much anger has there been about his... I mean, there's been a huge outpouring of sympathy and rejoicing today, but how much of a domestic political thing had this become in Burundi?
Oh, it had been quite an issue. But, you know, the one thing about Mr. Rugurika is that he still has his head on his shoulders, which is quite a difference from neighbouring Rwanda, where he would almost certainly have not been picked up. There would just be a body in the ditch. And that is the difference between the two countries. I mean, both of them suffer from exactly the same problem. You have a Tutsi minority and a Hutu majority. And in Rwanda, it is the Tutsis that are on top and are determined to remain on top forever, although they're only 15% of the population. Ever heard that statistic before? Perhaps in South Africa. If they were white, you'd understand the story. And in Rwanda, in Burundi, you have exactly the same statistic, but it is the majority who are in control. And this, unfortunately, these differences cause terrible tensions in both country. They are unreconcilable differences, and I'm afraid this is, you know, at the root of all evil.
We will have to leave it there. Martin Plaut and James Boyce, thank you both very much as ever for joining us here at Midori House.
London, New York, Tokyo. This is Monocle 24.
London, New York, Tokyo. Това е Monocle 24.
Лондрис, Нова Йорк, Токио.
Лондон, Нью Йорк, Токио. Дете е Monocle 24.
Londonist, New Yorkist, Tokyost, se on Monocle 24.
London, New York, Tokyo, Monocle 24 des.
Londino, New York, Tokyo.
This is Monocle 24.
And there's plenty still coming up in the second half of today's show. We'll be reviewing the American news weeklies with our New York bureau chief. We'll find out why you can't import some Egyptian art to Egypt. And we'll review the latest books. But ahead of all that, Paul Osborne is here with the headlines.
Germany has requested a Greek request for a six-month loan extension from the Eurozone. The German finance minister said the proposal wasn't substantive, though he turned it down just a few minutes after the European Commission had said the request was positive. Greece risks running out of money by the end of February if there's no agreement, but it's not requesting an extension of the existing bailout, as that would mean continuing with austerity measures. There's been intense shelling around the eastern Ukrainian city of Donetsk, piling further pressure on the precarious ceasefire there. Government forces say they're also coming under attack from pro-Moscow rebels near the city of Mariupol. Leaders of Russia, France and Germany have criticised the continued violations of the truce. British fighter aircraft have intercepted Russian long-range bombers off the southwest coast of England. The RAF scrambled fighter jets to intercept the planes. The Russian bombers were escorted until they'd flown further away. And Niger's declared 3 days of national mourning after 37 people died in an airstrike close to the border with Nigeria. They were attending a funeral, while across the border a major operation against Boko Haram militants was underway. And those are the latest headlines on Monocle 24.
Thank you, Paul. Welcome back to Midori House. You're live on Monocle 24. It's 21:32 in Moscow, 18:32 in London, 16:32 in Rio. Time now for What the Weeklies Say. It's our regular look at the weekly news magazines from one particular corner of the world. Today, we are heading to the United States, and I'm joined in the studio here in London by Ed Stocker, our bureau chief in New York City, who is visiting us. Ed, you have three venerable American titles. Well, two venerable ones and one kind of parvenu upstart, but
I do indeed.
What do you want to start with?
I want to start with Bloomberg Businessweek. We've got quite a fetching cover.
They here. Always have got quite a fetching cover, Bloomberg Businessweek, in fairness.
We've got a granny or an elderly person.
Extremely.
With a cake in front of her, apparently announcing that she's celebrating 173 years.
She looks well on it.
She does. She looks pretty good, doesn't she? I could probably knock 100 years off that, but hey. So this is a story about rapamycin. Now, I'm not sure if I've actually pronounced that correctly, but this is being touted as a possible new wonder drug. It's actually a rare bacterium extracted from soil on Easter Island, so a little bit obscure.
Isn't this the plot of Cocoon? is this, I mean, Bloomberg tends not to print nonsense. This reads at the outset like one of those stories that turns up on the front page of the Daily Express here in the UK twice a week. Is this actually a thing?
Well, I mean, there's been fairly recent testing on mice, and it's showing that there've been a lot of there's been a lot written about this so-called grape extract that's meant to extend your life. There've been a lot of kind of much touted remedies for longevity, I guess, that haven't worked, and this one looks like it's possibly going to be the one with the most potential. It does have a flip side, however.
Inevitably,
it suppresses the immune system. which isn't particularly good if you're old and susceptible to illnesses.
At 173, I would reckon a cold could be troublesome.
Exactly. So they've got still got a few things to iron out, but it's quite interesting. And it's also interesting that we have another publication, Time, that has covered exactly the same story. So we have two American weeklies that are basically leading with exactly the same story.
You can see why Time magazine would be especially interested in substances that will prolong life expectancy.
Ooh. Ouch. Quite interesting, though, also that they've reached two completely different conclusions about numbers. So they've Bloomberg has got an elderly woman with 173 years. Then Time has gone the other way and has a picture of a baby on its cover, saying this baby could live to be 142 years old. So I'm not entirely sure how each publication has reached those two separate numbers.
What do you think of the two different covers? I much prefer the Bloomberg one myself.
I'm a bit of a sucker for colours. So
yeah, the Time one just looks like, here's another one of those, it just looks like, you know, generic clip art baby photo.
And I find giant pictures of babies a little bit disturbing, but maybe that's just me.
There is also that. I don't have anything against babies.
I think on a magazine cover.
Not as disturbed as I still am now that I think of it by the idea of 170-year-old mice.
Yeah.
Better than
170-year-old rats for me.
That does have to be a concern. But does Time sort of take a different approach to the actual story?
Well, I mean, what they've done is they've done a longevity report. So they've basically done a whole list of features. And so that one of them is kind of fairly similar to the one we've seen in Bloomberg Business Week. The story I wanted to talk about was where is the best place to be an old person. They've chosen to do this article on the back of it. And I thought they might kind of list the places that people are going to, but instead they're looking at how there's a growing trend of people actually staying in the places that they've grown up in or spent the majority of their life. So people are choosing to remain in cities where you have access to good transportation or access to good healthcare, choosing to those advantages over moving perhaps to the countryside or the trend. This is written from a very American perspective. Obviously, the trend for elderly people to move to Florida is slowing down. Apparently, 71% of baby boomers say they want to grow older where they spent most of their adult lives. So that looks like that this Florida trend is reversing.
And also people have realized that Florida is just awful.
Nice weather, though.
I don't know, really. It's like being in a restaurant kitchen full of people in Hawaiian shirts who use the word party as a verb.
I haven't been there in the height of summer, so I'll take your word for it.
Okay. What else do you have there?
Well, we have quite a smooth transition because we're looking at longer life. We're finishing on a bit of a morbid subject because we're looking at death. This is Newsweek. It's actually the European edition of this US magazine. So it's looking at the issue of suicide actually in the UK. The front cover of a man holding an umbrella with it raining says, "Why are men killing themselves?"
We should note that the rain is under the umbrella. I think it's actually quite a good image.
Yeah, it's not a bad image. I don't think there's a lot of substance to the article, to be quite honest with you. I mean, it's basically off the back of the fact that in 2013, more than 6,000 people in the UK died and 78% of them were men. So that's kind of the key figure that this article is built around. But it's over three spreads, and I don't think it says that much. It talks a little bit about some of the issues, you know, obvious perhaps, you know, men aren't perhaps as good at communicators or don't want to talk about mental health issues and things like that, suggesting these are perhaps the reasons why more men aren't dealing with their problems and choosing to commit suicide than women. But I'm not sure, other than the statistics, whether it adds a huge amount to the argument.
The idea that men are not as communicative as they might be, it's not a dazzlingly original notion, is it?
Exactly. So, I mean, from my point of view, it feels a little bit like filler at times. Well, I just think it could have been a shorter article, but they've chosen. I mean, it's interesting that more men are committing suicide. I also learned that Lithuania has the highest suicide rate in Europe, which I didn't know. So we've all learned something today. I actually thought it was somewhere in Scandinavia, but there you go.
That is one of those urban legends that has settled around the Scandinavian people, I think, in the UK in particular. I'm not quite sure where that comes from.
There you go. I'm spreading rumours on the radio.
Well, Ed Stocker, thank you very much for joining us. That was with your summary of Newsweek, Time and Business Week. We should also mention that episode 155 of The Urbanist, our programme about cities, focused on exactly one of those subjects, which was the best places to grow old. And that is, of course, available on our website. You are listening to Midori House on Monocle 24. Up next, we'll be asking why a newly published book on revolutionary graffiti in Cairo has been barred by Egyptian authorities. Do stay with us.
Miami was all washed up, but then a brand new breed of art galleries and a boatload of art collections sailed in. Monocle's culture editor Robert Bound finds out how this big bad city turned into a bright-eyed and bushy-tailed art town.
There's warm weather art here, sure, and flesh on show. Why not? And there's the saleable big, bright and bold. But there's good art for sale too. Things that mean things. This city's become a magnet.
Son of a Beach, the Miami art scene. Now playing in the films menu on monocle.com.
Welcome back to Midori House on Monocle 24, 1840 here in London. Now, as is often the case with civil insurrection, Egypt's revolution of 2011 and onwards was fought not only with bottles and bricks, but paint. Cairo's Tahrir Square in particular became an impromptu gallery of modern agitprop artworks. A German publisher compiled some of the best of these works into a book, along with explanatory essays by various journalists, historians and activists. Entitled Walls of Freedom, it's available now. Just not in Egypt, where authorities have impounded the first consignment. Earlier, I asked Jonathan Geyer, senior editor for the Cairo Review of Global Affairs, to explain why.
Well, street art has been one of the main products of the Egyptian revolution since 2011. Graffiti has proliferated throughout the city, and the most iconic works of street art are in Tahrir Square, that epicenter of the revolution. And they really chronicle the day-to-day machinations of the uprising. Still today, there are images of martyrs of the revolution, young kids who died amidst violence against the authorities, memorialized on the walls of Tahrir Square. And it's an always evolving mural of the faces, the moments, the really deep, dark, and disturbing scenes of the uprising.
Are the graffiti, are the murals, are they mostly that? Are they mostly pictures, or is there political sloganeering as well?
Andrew, the graffiti of the Egyptian uprising and of course, of the counter-revolution today is everything. It's political, it's social, it's angry, it's funny. There's, you know, guides of how to protest respectfully or effectively. There are angry responses to the beating up of protesters. Even recently, a female protester was shot in downtown Cairo last month. And there are stencils of her assassination by authorities was caught on camera. And this iconic image is being stenciled throughout Cairo.
So can you tell me a bit about the book, Walls of Freedom? Does it just present the images with no particular commentary or context? Or is it, in fact, the revolutionary tract that the authorities are claiming it is?
Walls of Freedom is indeed a somewhat revolutionary book, a collaboration of a number of artists along with a German publishing house. It obviously has a sexy title, so that's why this story has gone so viral. But a year ago, books from the same publishing house that is importing them to Cairo also had three books censored. So even though the finance ministry has called this book, you know, inciting of violence and such, there are many books about graffiti available in bookstores in downtown Cairo and throughout the country. It's not a huge departure from the chronicling of the revolution we've seen in a number of volumes.
So why have they decided to make a thing out of this one, do we think? Is it because that there is an international connection?
It's hard to say, Andrew. The publishing house Tanwir, which means enlightenment in English, has been censored before, so it might have something to do with this publishing house, which publishes in Lebanon but is Egyptian. There is something very rich about a book called Walls of Freedom, a publishing house called Enlightenment, being censored. But of course, censorship is a consideration that all cultural producers and creators face here in Cairo. There's a number of archaic laws. From what I understand, this censorship incident falls under a 1936 publications law, deeming publications that are an insult or an affront to the state and allowing their censorship. So there's a litany of 100 plus laws that limit free expression here. And what artists and writers do is they have to work around these laws constantly.
Obviously, the question of censorship, freedom of expression, et cetera, in Egypt has been focused for much of the last year and some change through the prism of the case of the Al Jazeera three, at least two of whom are now free, one of whom, in fact, Peter Gresta is speaking in London, not far from where we're broadcasting tonight. But is there a feeling in Egypt that now Egypt's got rid of the ones that were attracting, or at least dealt with the case to an extent that was attracting all the international attention, that they're now free to go on censoring and repressing at a domestic level without anyone else really caring?
Well, there's been a number of worrying signals. For instance, the Prime Minister this week signed a decree that they'll be monitoring and removing so-called terrorist websites. And of course, the definition of what a terrorist website would be is very confusing. There's additionally at least 12 Egyptian journalists behind bars, obviously not getting the same international attention as the Al Jazeera 3. And there's a number of independent news organizations here that are locally driven and working hard to uncover all of the corruption and other government malfeasance occurring in the country. And it just is a testament to how difficult that is amid these circumstances.
Do you get the sense that this particular story and the story attached to it, that of censorship and freedom of expression, and this sounds like a counterintuitive question, is censorship a big story? Because really, how would you know? But do you know what I mean? Is this a source of enormous concern among Egyptian media and indeed among the Egyptian population? Or is this one of those things that maybe the international press has got more excited about, obviously, because it affects them directly?
The Arab Network for Human Rights Information, a major watchdog organization here in Cairo, has called it a crime, and I quote, a flagrant attempt to erase the memory of the uprising. So certainly for people here who are clinging to the hopes of the 2011 uprising, this is certainly offensive and insulting. However, there is a large majority of Egyptians who are clinging to stability and are seeking sort of papering over of all these issues that the uprising brought to the fore.
And just finally, the actual graffiti, the artworks that the book considers, the actual Tahrir Square graffiti, is that all still there, or are the authorities removing it or have removed it or thinking about removing it or what?
So the Tahrir Square graffiti is still there. It's always evolving. I mean, graffiti is ephemeral by nature, so it's not the same graffiti in the book that you can see today. But there have been many attempts over the past years to paint over the graffiti that surrounds Tahrir Square. And often within minutes or hours, it's repeated to new images of fallen protesters and political slogans. So that's sort of the irony of this censorship incident, is they can stop the book from coming in, but the graffiti will continue to be painted over again and again.
That was Jonathan Geyer, senior editor for the Cairo Review of Global Affairs, speaking to me earlier. Walls of Freedom is available now, unless, of course, you're listening in Egypt, from wallsoffreedom.com. Coming up for 1848 in London. Time now for some music on Midori House. This is Charlie XCX and Rita Ora, apparently.
we're alive. Yeah, together we're so alive. A joy like a jewel, let it sparkle. You know that I got your back for life. Yeah, I got your back for life. Like the sun.
That was Charlie XCX and Rita Ora with Doing It. It's 18:52 near enough here in London. You're listening to Midori House on Monocle 24. Time now for our daily arts review. Today we're talking about books. I'm joined once again by Fleur MacDonald, editor of the Omnivore literary website. Fleur, welcome to the programme as ever. First of all, I'm quite excited about this because you have bought in a book which I am actually myself reading at the moment. Well, not right at the moment because I'm presenting a radio programme, but earlier on my way here, I was reading it, which is Peter Pomerantsev. The title is a bit of a handful. Nothing is true and everything is possible. Adventures in Modern Russia. Timely, to say the very least.
Very timely. And in fact, I think it finishes in 2014. So he's really up to date. I don't know actually how you could put it down. I would still be on the bus reading the book because it's so great. And the title may be a bit of a mouthful, but the rest of the book isn't. He writes with such sort of ease and fluidity, and he knows Russia so well.
It does read like listening to somebody who's just come back from somewhere and is telling you, oh my God, and then this other amazing thing you'll never believe happened, but it actually all did.
Well, it helps that he came to Russia to be a reality TV producer, and also because he has Russian parents, he wanted to rediscover his roots. So for 9 years, he spent his time in Moscow basically interviewing the weird and the wonderful in Russia, which, as you can imagine, are all very weird and wonderful.
He does, as you say, go to Russia to produce mostly terrible reality television programs. But what he discovers in the book is that there's no more metaphorically perfect job to be doing in today's Russia than being a reality TV producer. Because as he depicts it, Russia itself is basically some ghastly reality show.
Well, it's a ghastly reality show that's being directed by not only Putin, but also his kind of PR guru, who's the Russian version of Peter Mandelson, Vladislav Surkov, who is the grand puppeteer. And they use the media and bodies like Russia Today to propagate their message, which is one that I don't think will I don't think we really understand it in the West, because it's not about Russia is great. It's about the West is bad.
No, it's a really useful book for that reason, because what you can see in all coverage of the Ukraine crisis especially is a complete failure of both Russia and the West to understand how each other sees the world. There is that extraordinary mutual incomprehension that we did see during the Cold War, and then I think we had that sort of 10 or 20 years of thinking, oh, we're all basically on the same side now. And it turns out we're not.
And it turns out we're not. And what's more frightening is that you get the impression that the ordinary Russians don't really care. So they're stuck in this world where they can't think about their past because it's full of such tragedy. But the narrative that pins their present and their future is completely fabricated by these people in charge.
Okay, well, that's Nothing is True and Everything is Possible, Adventures in Modern Russia by Peter Pomerantsev. Highly recommended.
And extremely funny, too.
It is, actually. We should definitely make that clear. It's a very, very funny book, if incredibly bleakly so in parts. You want to keep it Russian by talking about Bill Browder's new one.
Yeah, I'm keeping it completely Russian. So Bill Browder is the investment banker who started Hermitage Capital in 2000. No, it was in 1996, and he did so just as Russia was turning from communism to capitalism.
The late 90s, that's the proper Wild West era.
Exactly, and so he turns up,
I guess.
And that's actually one of the ways he describes it, and it does read like a thriller. So he turns up, and basically the Russian government are giving a privatization voucher to each citizen in Russia. But of course, if you're a citizen stuck in Siberia, you don't really know what this piece of paper means. In fact, it's giving you a percentage of the Russian businesses that were privatized at that point. So all of these vouchers are floating around, and basically Bill Browder strides in and with the help of Western money buys up all of these vouchers and becomes an extremely wealthy man. The only problem is that Russians want to take a piece of that money off him. He doesn't quite understand up till that point how lawless Russian business is.
The name of his book is Red Notice. He was a participant in the extraordinary collapse of the Russian state in the mid 90s. Does he feel regretful or guilty or like that?
He feels regretful because one of his tax lawyers, Sergei Magnitsky, basically was imprisoned and tortured to death because he refused to give in and he wanted to stand up for what he believed was right, i.e. that Bill Browder's investment capital fund was behaving lawfully. So the end of the book is Bill Browder's fight to rehabilitate Sergei Magnitsky's his reputation, but also put a law through the American Senate which froze all the assets of those involved in his case, which he was successful in 92. And to be honest, it's actually the most positive of all of the books I read, because it does actually offer a solution. There needs to be sort of international agreement about how we deal with human rights issues in Russia.
Okay, that's Red Notice by Bill Browder, which leaves us with about 10 seconds to discuss your third and final Russian selection.
So he goes out of, so it's David Green and it's Midnight in Siberia, and it's his train journey on the Trans-Siberian Railway. It's sentimental, but it does show you another view of Russia, i.e. outside Moscow.
I will read the book because I have done the rail journey, which I also do recommend. Fleur MacDonald, editor of The Omnivore, thank you very much for joining us. That is all we have time for on today's Midori House. My thanks in particular to our earlier guests, James Boyce and Martin Plout. Today's show was produced by Thomas Lewis, researched by David Pleasant and Kate Bullivant. Our studio managers were Wei Dong Lin and Bill Lutie. Up after the headlines, you can hear Andrew Tuck with The Urbanist at 2200, I should say. I will be back with Nancy Durham for The Monocle Daily. Midori House returns at 1800 London time tomorrow. But for this edition, goodbye and thank you for listening.